Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Sync for the 22nd of February. Starting in on RFCs. So there's quite a lot to discuss, I think, right now in RFCs. So let's start somewhere easy, which is on number 79. Which is add RFC for bare FFI lambdas. I know Joe put this forward and Benoit's already gone through it. I've gone through it too. Does anyone else have any thoughts on this, Theo, Gordon? Okay. My thought on this is that this looks great. There is a bit here about putting methods on primitives that are at qualified and saying maybe we could do that later. So, two things about this. Number one is I'm not sure if we can do it later unless we take a slightly different compilation strategy because currently lambdas are compiled as primitives. And so we would need some type to put the lambda on, if that makes any sense. We could theoretically do it another way, but it would mean extending how reachability works and a whole bunch of other stuff works, and it'd be easier just to stick it on a type.
Right. So what I was saying there is that it wouldn't be exposed as something that the user could do from valid syntax.
That makes sense.
Yeah. It would be something that we were doing internally, and maybe we could expose it later if we thought there was a good reason to do so.
That's right.
But yeah.
Yeah. And then that got me thinking too, well, what if you did write it as valid syntax with the at? How would you pass one around? And partial application seems like the way to do it, even though it would look a little bit funny because it would be type tilde method name, even though you're not really capturing this in it. But that sort of seems okay. Like, that doesn't seem too crazy. What do you think?
So, I wouldn't say it's crazy.
Okay.
It might be a little bit, well, okay, so yeah, let's say that, you're talking about strictly about the case where a user has a primitive and they've defined, hey, here's an at method on the primitive, yeah. And I want to reference that. And I think that makes sense to use partial application to do it.
Because the other way we could do it is we could allow dot referencing just the function with no parens on the end of it and treat it almost like a field. So that's currently disallowed in the compiler, but only because we special case it, right? It's not disallowed by the BNF at all. But I don't know.
Yeah. So just kind of going back to the point about, I guess where it gets a little bit fuzzy if we're allowing both to define them on a type and also to create the bare lambdas, sort of in line as an expression that evaluates to an object reference that you can pass to a C function.
Right.
The issue I think it gets into there is what is the value of that object? Is it a reference to the primitive, which we sort of implicitly expand to be in the C call, if you pass it as an argument, the phony compiler would see that this is a primitive that was created to be just an at to be a bare lambda. So I'm gonna go ahead and assume that you don't want to pass the pointer to the primitive, but what you want is the pointer to the apply method of the primitive. Which, I mean, and you could use the partial application or just like dot apply there as well, but it's a little bit awkward because it's like I created this lambda. I don't want to have to call. It's a little bit counterintuitive that to call dot apply on it to get access to the real function object.
I agree completely. I think that for that, for the lambda, you're absolutely right. You shouldn't have to do that. It should be just, if it was let x equal at lambda, then x is the function pointer.
Right.
I think you're absolutely right. And
so what pony type does x have?
It would have the type, which would be, in the same way that you can write a lambda as a type,
mm-hmm.
It would have the type of at, of the at lambda, basically. That would
right.
be then a type. And that sounds crazy complicated, but it's not, because it can't be a subtype of anything ever.
Right. But I guess it's just that when we're doing the FFI call, then we need to implicitly expand, or, you know, we need to implicitly dereference the, I don't know. If we were allowing users to create their own primitives with one or more at methods on them,
yeah,
then would, if one of those methods was named apply, would yeah. that primitive be a subtype of the at lambda type?
No.
That's where it gets hairy.
It wouldn't. No, I think it's straightforward. I might be thinking about this wrong, but I think it's straightforward, which is to say, the primitive, let's say we have some primitive foo with a collection of at methods on it. The primitive is actually a primitive type, right? So it can be a subtype of things. It has a V table. It might have other methods that means it conforms to some interface. Its at methods are the actual function pointers. So if you had one of those and you wanted to put its apply method in some struct in order to pass it to C, you would actually do foo.apply or foo tilde apply parens, depending on the syntax.
Okay, so...
to get the function pointer as opposed to the primitive. And they would have two different types.
Right. So I guess unlike a tilde, sorry, I'm mixing up my words here. Unlike a lambda, a normal lambda type, where if I create a primitive that has an apply method, then the lambda type that matches that apply method. If I do partial application to get, you know, primitive tilde apply, which I don't need to do, but I could do, that the lambda type matches both the partial application result value and also the primitive itself. And so this is kind of an inconsistency in my mind where that would not be true for the at lambda.
That's right. That's right. Similarly to how a struct is different because it doesn't have a V table or type information or anything like that. The at lambda isn't a sort of complete lambda, as it were, right? You can't just use it where you would use anything else that might have an apply method.
Right.
Just like you can't use a struct when you expect, you know, some struct can't be used for any.
Mm-hmm.
Seems weird at first until you go, oh, well, right, it doesn't have any type information. There's nothing we can do with that.
All right. I mean, it seems a little bit, I don't know, it seems a little bit weird to me, but again, I think it does help avoid the weirdness of having to implicitly expand the primitive reference to the function pointer when doing an FFI call. Like, it avoids that problem completely. So.
Right, because you just have the FFI lambda, the at lambda, and it would really just be x open parens, here's your stuff.
Okay.
Or I'm thinking about this completely wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything wrong or like problematic with what you're saying, other than just sort of, I guess, from a learning perspective, the incongruency of having, like I said before, a Lambda type would match both the primitive that implements that method and also the partial application value of that
right
method. Whereas for an at Lambda, it only matches the partial application value.
Well, that seems like a pretty good argument that we should allow foo.apply to reference an at method and get a function pointer to make it clear that it isn't partial application and it isn't capturing anything.
I suppose that's true. Okay, so in this case, if we expand the RFC to allow specifying at methods, it seems like they wouldn't need to be limited to primitives. There's no reason not to allow them on any object, just as long as you have the compiler restraint that you can't use this anywhere within.
Right.
At that point, you could just do a fun at whatever, and it would prevent you from like specifying a capability, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you would do type name dot method name to get the function pointer. You wouldn't do it on an instance. I mean, I guess you could do it on an instance, but we wouldn't need to allow that, right? Like that might be more trouble than it's worth, because it would imply that the instance was tied to the method somehow. So type name dot method name seems like a better way to get at it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I suppose, because I guess if for some reason we thought that allowing this dot to use it later was helpful in some way, then we could choose to allow it later, but for now we keep it disallowed and assume that it's confusing and shouldn't do it.
Okay,
I'll amend the RFC along those lines, and we can.
All right, cool. Awesome. Also, this is a really nice solution to something that has been floating out there for a while. Nice one.
Thanks.
Okay. A little bit of discussion, I think, on number 78, which is RFC for network errors handling. Basically that I think this conversation on this has gone really well. I think it's looking good. I don't think it's mergeable right this minute, but in the sense that moving towards errors only on failed calls, I think is the right way to go. That way there isn't some error no value that's kept in the type, and it can just be propagated when the error actually happens, which seems pretty sensible. Is everyone else feeling sort of roughly the same about it?
I think so.
All right, cool. And then I guess we can get into things like names for socket errors and things like that. Like error no is awful. We really don't want the no on there. We don't want it in file, and we don't want it here. It should be socket error, and socket okay should not be one of them, right? Because on okay, we don't want that. But right. Things like unknown error or in use or connection refused or unreachable or timeout, that's fine. Those are all good. I think where possible, the abbreviations we should probably get rid of. So like socket refused might be good. Socket unreachable, socket timeout. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's something to be said for correlating closely to the C names, but there's also something to be said for staying far away from that.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But yeah, I think that can all kind of be discussed sort of asynchronously from there.
Yeah, cool. All right, awesome. And then that means we get to talk about the big one.
I was going to say, I could tell you were just stalling before talking about 76, right?
Of course, yeah. Number 76, stateful exceptions. So this is a really, really, really big change to contemplate for many reasons. Yeah. So things that this accomplishes, so it seems like basically one of the core issue here, as far as I can tell, is constructors. Everywhere I'm looking, there are examples, which, by the way, Benoit did an awesome job of not just putting in examples, but there's a complete implementation of the files package that uses this, if anyone hasn't seen it. And it's fantastic. It just really concentrates the mind in terms of, oh, right, it's exactly these kinds of things that are the issue. So it's just really good. Anyway, so for example, if we take the example of directory, the main thing that it needs to do is raise an exception if we can't create one. There's another one in here, which is it returns, it can raise one on array string ISO hat. When it, on entries, it would normally return an array of entries, right? But if you don't have the capability to read it, or if it didn't open properly or something like that, then it can raise an error. That's a case that could pretty easily be handled as a union return type. And even opening a directory that's relative to this one, the open call, seems like that could also be. Like, it's sort of interesting about where there are errors, or makedir is a really classic one, where it's returns none or raises an error. And it seems like that should just be a return type there. Is this making any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
My main issue with that kind of thing, and there is a like for example for the entries function, is that you have to match on the return type, and one of my idea with this RFC is to not have to match on return values to avoid an additional cost on when we do to do the operation I think it's like a return type, an error type. It's I think it's almost like a union of in for the return type, except that in some case it's a local return. You return at the point of the call, right, with some value, and in the other case you go elsewhere in the exception handler.
Yeah. I really, really worry that this leads to programming with non-local returns, as has happened in every single other language that has exceptions with types. Exceptions with values, I should say, because it doesn't even have to be typed, right? Python programmers do it all the time. They just raise exceptions as another way of returning a value. Leading to extremely difficult to understand control flow because it does not follow any kind of sensible path. I'm sorry, Benoit, I think we lost you there. Can you say that again?
I wanted to say that but for example in Python they it's an idiom in the language and libraries, but maybe if we can advocate for good idioms, like only using errors for things that are really errors, and that means that if you return you're in an inconsistent state and you can continue, maybe we can solve that kind of
right.
So
I don't know if that makes sense.
I just wanted to kind of say that Sylvan, does it help at all that that an exception with a value couldn't be like silently propagated up through multiple layers of methods without those methods also containing the type signature that says this method can raise this type of value? Because as I understand it in the RFC, like if you have foo, function foo that calls bar, and foo is just partial, where it just has the question mark, and bar is partial with a type, that the error from inside bar could not be propagated up to the caller of foo. It would not be allowed by the type system because foo can only raise an error none. Is that correct? And does that address any of the sort of issues about difficult to understand constructions, Sylvan?
Yes and no, Minister. So being fully checked in that way and putting the pressure on the API, much as Midori did, is a good thing, right? We like this. We like this very much. But it does beg the question of encapsulated exceptions. And what happens if you want to throw an exception while handling an exception, and should you get an exception chain, right? This is the stuff that has been struggled with in Java 7 and Java 8 and in recent .NET changes of trying to figure out how chains of exceptions work. And Pony doesn't have that problem currently because there's no value, right? It doesn't really matter. An error is an error is an error. But in this case, as soon as you get into the situation of, oh, I've seen some error, but I need to also throw an error, what should get propagated?
Well, I think we shouldn't really try to handle that, because like if you raise an exception and then get in the handler, you know what kind of exceptions you can raise in that handler. You control what you're going to do, and yes. I don't like if you call something that can raise an exception. You know that's
except immediately we get into the situation.
That's
someone.
A possibility.
Oh, sorry.
So I think it's more a matter of.
So what this immediately leads to is as soon as someone wants.
I didn't really hear what you said.
Oh, sorry. What that leads to is that immediately, as soon as someone wants to express this kind of behavior, they write a type exception chain. An exception chain has within it a list of any val. And every time you get an exception, you create a new exception chain that extends the list of the previous exception chain that has every exception in it, and everything gets typed with I raise an exception chain. And if we think that won't happen, we're crazy, because people will want to use this feature to do that kind of handling if it's available. And that's a big, big problem. Do you see what I mean about how this becomes arbitrary non-local return instantly?
Yes.
So, just brainstorming a bit, if the issue is not necessarily like the change itself, but the sort of slippery slope of you know, things that can cause bad ways people can use it. I'm not gonna like try to like say, oh, slippery slope fallacy. It doesn't follow. I think it's definitely a slippery slope is a real thing that you have to actually be concerned about when building systems. And I think, but we might be able to sort of tweak the incentives or make it unpleasant to do that sort of thing, or you know, kind of examine what would that look like. How can we make it unpleasant to do the anti-pattern and pleasant to do the good patterns that we like, sort of figure out and adjust the discussion sort of toward like figuring out like what, if we went forward with this change, how could we incentivize users to do it in a way that is, or to use it in a way that we consider to be productive and good for the community. It's just one angle, I think, to think about it with, because
I think it's a very reasonable angle. Yeah.
And obviously, I don't think we're going to figure it out today necessarily.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but we can at least think about it and talk about it. We also don't want a situation where we get some people sometimes programming in Pony and they say, oh, there's an exception. Where's my stack trace? And even in the RFC, there's stuff about, oh, you can have a class that has a source log that then bubbles up. And this is all wrong. debugging features and language features are not the same thing. And having debugging features in your actual runtime or in your program is a bad idea. It just leads to them being used in unpleasant ways. The ways that I've seen stack traces used in real-world programs are frightening, frankly. And the source should not logically exist when the program runs, right? In the same way that types don't logically exist in the compiled version of Pony, they do for virtual dispatch, but almost nothing else. They leak into there with serialization a bit, but not as much as you'd think, right? And similarly, the source is not should not be what you're dealing with. I mean, I'm open to arguments to the contrary, but carrying that kind of information around is problematic.
Yeah, I think what you're saying makes sense.
So Haskell has a method of dealing with this where effectively it is always using return types and not exceptions. It doesn't do non-local returns. But you can write code that looks an awful lot like it's doing a non-local return because it will only continue with a computation with certain... if you get a non-error result. And that can be a quite nice way of going about things that, in the sense of not having non-local returns because you have control flow that's understandable, but it leads to the problem that Benoit was talking about, which is, and that Joe Duffy writes about in the Midori postmortem, of a lot of times for performance reasons, you don't want to check the result, right? And with a proper exception where you really expect this to not happen, you don't want to check the result. It's expensive and it can add up really quickly compared to the exception case where you don't have that pattern matching overhead.
So here's a question. Is there something we can do with unions, like some kind of like, I don't know, an annotation or something that could be added to functions that return a union and say, this is the normal case and we have some way, the generated code has some way of communicating to you if that's violated and you need to do the match. Otherwise, the match gets like skipped. I'm not sure what that would look like. I'm just kind of throwing out kind of generated code hackery we could do to get the performance benefits of this without necessarily. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no. I think that's good thinking. But you would have to check a flag to do it. That sort of goes approach, right? Is, hey, return two things. Return the error and the result. And if the error is null, then handle the result. And if the error is not null, then the result's going to be null, so handle the error. But that does mean that you're checking the error at each go.
Well, right. And also, that's something that it's not possible in user land right now to accomplish that, even if I return a tuple and add one of the elements of the tuple is some sort of Boolean success, true or false, the type system doesn't, if I check that success is true, the type system in the compiler doesn't know that in that branch the second element of the tuple is of the success type, right?
Right, exactly. So you end up with the Go idiom of checking it in an if clause, and then you have the optional type, and yeah, it gets pretty dirty pretty quick.
I'm just wondering if maybe the generated code could do something, I don't know, hacky on the inside that the compiler knows will... You know, it returns a sort of implicit tuple. The compiler knows, hey, if this is true, I don't know if checking if true is actually any cheaper than a match. I assume it is. But.
No, it's just as expensive.
Okay.
Essentially, what it introduces is branching.
Right.
And yeah, your branch predictor is going to do as best it can at the hardware level to not pay a cost for that. But there's only so much it can do. And the advantage of exceptions, the way they're implemented in Pony is similar to the way they're implemented in C++, which is to say what they call zero cost exception handling. It's not actually zero cost, right? Because the binary is a little bit bigger. But in the case when, and that binary being bigger, right, isn't just a disk thing. It means that you can have, it affects your L1i cache and things like that. So it's not really zero cost. But it means that when an exception hasn't taken place, you have no branching.
Right.
But the exception itself, of course,
I think I may have an idea with about what Joe said with the code generator doing some magic. So maybe we could have exceptions without types that work as usual, and for example have some return type that's a union with the normal return type and some error type, like for example in files have some in the file package after have the for example the file package where you when you try to create a file you either get the file or you get some error in a union. And maybe we could try something like in the function you either do return some value or you do return error some value or something like that. And what that last return will do is that it will compile them to raising an exception with a value that would be caught immediately when exiting the function. And maybe we could come up with some syntax that would look like a match, but that wouldn't actually be a match. It will just simply be the normal path of the return or the exception landing pad. I think that may be an interesting idea to explore.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah. Because it allows it to be zero cost exceptions carrying a value, but takes away the non-local return aspect of it. That is very interesting. Another thing we could think about, because is that, I'm really liking that idea. I don't know quite what it looks like yet, but it sounds really good. But if you hadn't said that, I was going to say that what if we said that all errors had to be primitive types to avoid the heavy information carrying error problem? I don't know if that's just would just feel too restrictive to people once they were saying, oh, hey, I have a typed exception. Why can't I carry a string in it? Or if it would be sensible.
I think that could work because you could still put methods on the primitive.
Yeah, exactly. But then
I think we should explore Benoit's idea a little bit more, though.
I agree. And
something I was noticing when we were looking through this file package is that the the return type, file question mark, file error no, it looks a lot like a union sort of already. It's just kind of like a different type of union, right?
Yeah.
And maybe the question mark would become like a first class like way of specifying the type of something, like it's the TK question type or something like that in the compiler, to where if you have an expression that is of type, TK question type in the compiler, then you've got you know when you're evaluating that to set up your first of all, maybe you'd only be able to do it in the context of a match or a try, right? Because it could raise an error. If you just have it in a try block and it's not in a match, then the error value would just get lost, and you'd go to else, and the error value is discarded. But if it's in the match expression, then the compiler sees, hey, my match expression has type TK question type, so that means I know when I'm code generating to set up the landing pad for the exception and adapt the way I handle this branching to this different strategy of code generation.
Right. Huh, that's interesting. And that would also, yeah, that would give a, Another thing that we could think about is on constructors, the ability to specify a return type on a constructor if you want to, in which case, you're able to, you would be able to, with an explicit return, return something other than the object being constructed to give a proper union type return for a constructor, right? Because what if you have a constructor and you want to bail out and instead of raising an error, you want to return, some useful descriptive error.
Right. Although there at that point, I'm not sure a constructor is. I don't know.
The issue right now is that, like, in the existing I see what you mean, because of course, why not just wrap it, right?
I know why you can't wrap it. It's because you have to do it on a different type. You'd have to and I do this pattern all the time, and it sort of feels awkward to me. Is like. When I want to have like some sort of meta thing that could create an object, I had to create a new primitive called thing util, and it creates a thing or it does something else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You'd be surprised how many times you see like X util in all of my Pony programs, just because I don't have any other way to do something like a static method that's attached to a class.
Yeah. And I feel like for a lot of stuff, that's good, right? If it was really static and it didn't need an instance, then it shouldn't be on the same type. And that's sort of okay. But for a constructor, it's really kind of weird. I don't know. Maybe I'm talking nonsense there.
Yeah. But part of my point was that, if constructors could have a different return type that kind of lets you abuse them to use them as static methods, right? Which is kind of a good thing or kind of a bad thing. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, in the sense that the idea of it being in constructors, it would always be able to, if you specify a return type, it would have to include the type itself. Right.
Okay.
No fair writing one that can never construct the thing.
Yeah. Which I would say is something that I often want to do, but yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. I'm curious about when you want a method on a type that doesn't need an instance of that type?
Well, I think we had some discussion about this in the past. Let's kind of refocus probably back a little bit. Yeah. But I can go through all my code base. I can grep for every time I have a util in a primitive name. And
not okay. Yeah. So I'm quite interested in this idea of local exceptions that Benoit has and what a local exception might look like.
Well, I'll try to implement something. And
okay, cool.
Either update the RFC or open something else entirely.
Yeah. The other possibility, if that doesn't go where we want it to go for some reason, is maybe if you guys could think about how you would feel about only allowing primitives as in your exception union, what that might feel like. I think in terms of keywords, this is very, very, very minor, right? It's just syntax, doesn't matter. But it would be good if we kept else as the else branch and not having else error. I don't think we need else error. And then we could have it as try. So, for example, OCaml and F# use try with as opposed to try finally. Now with is already used, so it means we can't, because that might be an expression, we couldn't use with raw. We could, however, use the famous catch word, which then would be try catch else then, where else would be, it was an exception other than one that we had a case for in the catch. But anyway. Yeah. So I guess the conclusion is Benoit will look into local exceptions and then we'll come back to this.
Yes. Yes, I think.
Okay, cool. Also, as soon as I say things like try, catch, else, then, going back to Joe's idea of separating those two concepts seems really good.
All right, well, which concepts?
The concept of a finally and the concept of an error handler. So the OCaml try with versus the OCaml try finally.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that took hardly any time at all. And now, is there anything that anyone wants to look at? Because we have about 10 minutes scheduled left. And if anyone has any specific requests, we should handle them.
I did want to get to 1328 at some point.
Cool. So,
not sure if you have any more thoughts on that. 28. Where's the issue ticket? Sorry, I'm looking for the PR ticket. 1593.
I think you want, yeah, exactly, 1593. Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, I did have thoughts about this. So, as far as I can tell going through this code, I think possibly we don't need is cap sub cap bound at all.
And it should just be is cap sub cap.
Not only that, but possibly that entire branch in is type param sub type param, where we say if sub def equals super def, could be, you know, just yeah, I mean, it's is cap subcap and becomes vastly simpler.
Yeah, so actually, that's one of the things I tried. I found that the when doing so, the standard library had a lot of errors, which might mean that, that we just found a bunch of capability bugs in the standard library.
Possibly. Boy, I hope not. well, in some ways, I kind of hope we did, but... is there any chance you have one that we could look at?
If there's another issue we can talk about, let's go to that. And then in the meantime, I will be pulling up a complete output of what happens when that happens.
Okay. So
just so we're not all waiting awkwardly for me to give
a yeah. So 1610 looks like a really nice change to get the backtrace stuff in. But it's still failing on Windows. For some reason, it's claiming in gen header that it doesn't know what assert is, which seems unlikely, but that is what it's claiming.
There is no assert on that line. So I don't understand what's going on.
God, that is just so very. Sometimes building things on Windows every now and then is annoying. There isn't even a line 512 in gencall.c, is there? Oh no, there is. Should have guessed. Of course, gen call is going to be huge. Yeah, I don't know what the heck. I'm going to have a quick spelunk. And try and see what the heck it could possibly be complaining about in code that you haven't even changed line 512. Of course, because line 512 is a blank line.
Yeah, I thought it might be in the AST get children micro, but there doesn't seem to be an assert in that.
Right. And it looks like the release build. Oh no, it's the same. 512.
Oh, Gordon says in chat that there is an assert on line 512 in master. So I'm very always confused, maybe I'll try to push the change. I'll try to push the changes again. And maybe that will fix the problem.
Okay. I just did a git pull. Oh, look at that. But yeah, maybe if you rebase onto. If you rebase onto head and pick it up and see what happens, it looks like AppVar might be a little confused. Okay, cool. Moving on then.
I have it just one second.
Oh, cool.
There's not as many errors as I remembered there being, so they might all be legitimate errors. Yeah, I will paste it, and I will grab the link and put it to you fine folks. All right, the link is pasted in the chat for the gist.
Cool.
Let's see. There's basically there's a couple in array dealing with pointer. And then there's some in the implementations of list.fold and collections. Collections.list.fold.
Okay. So the core problem in array is that it thinks a hash any is not a subtype of a hash any alias, which it absolutely definitely is, but that's actually an is cap sub cap problem, where it's not seeing it as the same any, where this could, it's saying this could be any, as it were.
Right, but the rules of iscap subcap are that every type in the sub has to be a subtype of every instantiation of sub has to be a subtype of every instantiation of a super, which makes it really hard for any of the sort of set caps, the gen caps to line up with each other.
Right. This is like the best example you could possibly have pasted, because I think it tells me what we need to do.
Great.
So the core issue with this is, as usual, if you allow me to choose a name, I will choose the name most likely to confuse not only everyone else, but even me after some time. I assumed is cap sub cap bound was referring to constraint binding, but that's not what it's referring to. Is cap sub cap bound is saying, given that we have a set of possible capabilities, and we need to check subtyping, we also know that set is going to be reified to the same specific capability.
I think you lost me a little bit, but...
I apologize.
Go on.
Okay.
No, I don't think it's your fault.
No, I think it is. I think what I just said was probably meaningless, including to my own brain. So when we say if subdef equals superdef, we know something really powerful there, which is that when we're examining this type, whenever it's reified, these two capabilities are reified to the same thing, such that if there is a set, we can, instead of saying, gosh, on one side the any could be tag, and on the other side the any could be ISO, and tag is not a subtype of ISO, right?
Right. I think I see where you're going with this. Let me see if I can finish your sentence here.
Okay.
See if I got it. So for every one of the six caps, if the sub being if the sub being instantiated as that cap matches. Oh, wait, sorry. No, because this doesn't work when... Okay, sorry, I'll let you finish.
Okay, that's too bad. I was rather hoping you were going to finish. Which means that for a set of capabilities... We can choose the lower bound for any set. So that, for example, if it was any and any bang, we choose the lower bound, and it's, is ISO a subtype of ISO bang? And funnily enough, it is. Or if we had share, we could choose val. and val is a subtype of val, or val is a subtype of val bang. And we don't have to say, ooh, but tag isn't a subtype of val, because since they're going to be reified to the same thing, we can basically just pick one. And I think what we can do is, for to keep this as general as possible, where we could have some type, theoretically have some type parameter with some set on one side that isn't some set on the other. I don't think we can do that right now, but theoretically. Oh, we could do it. Actually, we could, because of an arrow being an arrow type on one side. Where we do is type param sub arrow. Yeah, let's actually puzzle this through. And we're not ignoring capabilities. And we are a subtype when we do ignore capabilities, at which point we reify sub. To its set. Oh, right. We reified it to its set at that point. Otherwise, we take the lower bounds, right, so they can be separate, but it's okay. So we got a lower bounds. Okay, so that was a lot of babbling, for which I apologize.
No, it's helpful. I was sort of following along a little bit.
Okay, cool. So I think the issue there is that the rule in is cap sub cap bound isn't the rule. It's wrong. And we can do something much, much simpler, which is get rid of that function entirely. Well, let me think about that. Ah, what if we say, oh, of course, never mind. Doesn't do what I thought it did. I thought the lower was going to give me the lower bounds, but it doesn't because I named it. Right, so we should keep the function is cap sub cap bound, but change the rule. And the rule is if the sets overlap. No, that's not right. Because in iscap subcap, we handle aliasing, and the super goes through cap aliasing to get the super alias. The super alias on TK any is TK cap alias. at which point no wonder this is complicated. Damn it.
I just wanted to say that seeing you struggle with this makes me feel a lot more validated with how much I struggle with.
Good. Excellent. As well you should, damn complicated thing. I think aliasing them first might be problematic, but the thing is we could get... Yeah. So the original rule is some instantiation of the sub RCAP must be a subtype of every instantiation of the super RCAP.
I think so, yeah.
And in your change, I'm wondering if we just thought this through wrong and actually that is the rule.
Okay, so we're wondering what happens if I put is cap sub cap bound back to how it was prior to this PR and keep everything else in the PR the same to where we redirect to it at the right time. I don't think it works, but I'm willing to.
I bet it won't work. I bet that the old implementation is subtly wrong, and the new implementation is subtly wrong in a different way. Is my guess, and that if you go back to using the old iscap subcap bound at the one place it was ever used, there will be a subtle bug. Okay. So the difference in the new implementation is you get rid of that crazy cap any bind, don't need that. Okay, the rule you wrote is the same, it's just phrased the other way around.
Yeah, I thought there was, looking at it, I thought it was different, but it might be the same.
Every
like I knew I just flipped the order of the sentences, but I thought there was a subtle change in that you're evaluating. But no, I think you're right that it's. No, actually, no, you're right. It is the same.
So, if we have an ISO, yeah, it's basically a subtype of every darn thing. Why is an ISO not a subtype of an ISO?
It is earlier with if sub equals
super. Oh, right. Yeah, we're checking equivalence. Thank you. Damn, fool me.
It just clears up a little bit of extra clutter.
Yeah.
Although maybe we should just take that out and be explicit in all cases so that we're a little more clear.
So every of sum.
And like I said in the comments, I noticed that when I went back through this, that there are a few other cases that weren't included in my PR, but that under that rule, like I said in this most recent comment in the PR, any TK cap any would be a subtype of everything.
Yeah.
But what that means is that creates the original problem that this issue was raised about, because we'd be treating TK cap any as a subtype of like ref, for example. So we could pass in a vowel as the type constraint. Pass in a vowel as the type argument. It meets the constraint of TK cap any, because any, you know, it meets everything. And we checked any as being a subtype of ref, so we can call a ref method on a receiver that we checked as having type TK cap any, but that's wrong. We can't, because we could have passed in a vowel, and now we're calling a ref method on something that is a vowel. Does what I said make sense? 1328. If you look at the reproduction that Benoit put.
Yeah, looking now. Thank you.
Or actually, the lower down, somebody posted one with any instead of read, but it's the same. It's the same problem. Like, just look at Benoit's the issue description where he has the snippet, and just picture read as being any, because it's the same exact problem.
Right.
Because when we look at...
But that's for checking subtyping.
Right, which is subcap bound is being called... Sorry, is type param subtype param is being invoked on the check to tell whether X can... can invoke boom.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden.
So I think maybe the problem is that is superdef equal subdef is not enough to know what we're taking it to mean, right?
Exactly. It's necessary but not sufficient.
Right.
Oh yeah. Because all of a sudden we've got some type param where we've slapped ref in there because that's the receiver capability.
Right.
But when we're doing assignment,
it would be the same thing, right?
How would we have some a ref? Logically, it would be. If we could say a ref, which we currently can't, it would be the same problem. It would say, oh, look, read, yeah, there's one of those that's a ref. Boom, same problem. You're absolutely right.
So one thing I'm wondering is whether we should switch up our logic based on whether we're comparing two sets, two gen caps versus a gen cap and a specific cap.
Yeah.
Because a call site is never going to have a gen cap, right? Like the... where we're talking about a ref here, that would never be a, because you can't specify a
correct
a method receiver capability that has a gen cap.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Neither can you. I mean, you shouldn't be. I believe we've got it set up so that you can't even have a method that looks like. I mean, a local variable that has a set of capabilities as opposed to a capability, right? If all goes well.
Right.
let's just check that.
So our rule would vary.
Yes, the error is a capability set can only appear in a type constraint. Yeah. And I think that solves it. Only apply the rule when you have two generics, two capability sets.
Okay. All right. So the rule is the same, except for if we're dealing with two specific capabilities or the subtype is a...
No, I think if either of them is a specific capability,
right,
is cap sub cap.
Right. And I don't think we need to make a branch, like a conditional branch to delegate that. I think we can just, you know, mess with our truth table until it comes out that way, right?
Yeah.
And state in the rule that if both caps are gen caps, then apply this rule. Otherwise, apply the same rule as is cap sub cap.
Yep.
Okay.
Wow, I'm really glad we talked through that because I had come to the totally wrong conclusion.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's what I need. So thanks.
Cool. Excellent. Right. On that note, we're well over time. I apologize, everybody. And I apologize to all listeners in the future. Is there anything that people want to cover before we jump off? Okay. Great. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.